You see, for about the first 10 years of the United Nations, the United States had a complete, clear majority, not only in the Security Council, but in the General Assembly. We had plenty of friends to vote for our side, so we never had to use the veto. However, when the smaller nations, satellites of the Soviet Union, as well as the Third World countries, began coming into the United Nations, then this majority changed. Eventually, even in the Security Council, and as a consequence, the United States, which had been very proud of its veto pure record, began using the veto as well as the Soviet Union.
As the Cold War was being waged in the United Nations, a change was taking place in the American environment surrounding UN headquarters in New York, with the rise of what became known as McCarthyism. How did this affect the United Nations?
Unfortunately, had a very severe effect on the United Nations, because many people then began to fear that the so-called foreigners within our midst were all spies. And some of the media, I may say, helped to encourage that point of view, because a spy story, especially centering on the United Nations, was always a headline story. And there were quite a few of those that came out, even though they were never really, as far as I know, substantiated. Anyhow, Henry Cabot Lodge, who was then the United States permanent representative at the United Nations, wanted to be sure that the United Nations was purer than pure. So he took the unusual step of bringing into the UN something that has never happened, that had never happened before, or has never happened since, as far as I know. He brought in the FBI to fingerprint American employees to make sure they were loyal to the United States and not spies against it. This is the only time I've ever heard of, and I think this is true, that a national police force has been brought inside the international enclave, which is the United Nations and supposedly a unit, in an international unit in and of itself, to check on its own employees. And moreover, the employees of the United Nations are supposed to be international employees and no longer representatives of their own national governments. Well, that isn't always true of some other countries. It was a little disturbing to think that we even questioned Americans at that particular time. Of course, Henry Cabot Lodge's efforts did not produce any spies, as far as I know. As far as I know, no American employee of the United Nations has ever been indicted or convicted of being disloyal to the United States. As an interesting footnote, Henry Cabot Lodge, the representative of the United Nations at this particular time, was the grandson of the Henry Cabot Lodge who led the fight against the United States becoming a member of the League of Nations. Whether or not there's any relationship between the two points of view remains for the historians to try to evaluate.
Lodge eventually left the UN in 1960 to run for vice president on the Republican ticket with Nixon. His successor at the United Nations was Adlai Stevenson. What can you tell us about him?
Those of us who were present when Adlai Stevenson walked into the Security Council chamber for the first time saw an unusual demonstration. Every single member around that horseshoe table applauded, and then each one made a little address of welcome, even the Soviet delegate. As I say, this was unheard of as far as most of us could remember. In other words, Adlai Stevenson came there as a man of the highest regard. He was known around the world. He was an international citizen. And it was looked upon as a great evidence of the United States' belief in the United Nations that a man of this stature should be appointed to this particular post. Unfortunately, this standing did not last too long, through no fault of Adlai Stevenson's. Scarcely 3 months after he was assigned to his post, his own government kept him in ignorance about the facts of the Bay of Pigs invasion, and he was allowed to testify falsely in the Security Council about that invasion. As one sorrowful observer remarked to me, he came here as a superman and now he's been reduced to a man. Well, Stevenson once said in my hearing, "I never thought they'd do this to me." Nevertheless, Adlai Stevenson was widely respected and deeply loved. He always had a quip and an inspirational word as well. I remember one time his saying that a UN diplomat was one part protocol, one part alcohol, and one part geritol. I think it can be said to this day that two of the most respected and loved human beings who were ever associated with the United Nations were Americans, and they were Adlai Stevenson and Eleanor Roosevelt.
The Cold War had another unfortunate effect on the United Nations. This concerned the Charter Articles on the Security Council's military requirements for the maintenance of peace. What happened to these important provisions of the Charter?
The Charter provided that member nations should make armed forces available to the Security Council for use in case of an international problem that could not be handled by peaceful means. And so a military staff committee was set up. It was made up of chiefs of staff or their representatives from the five permanent members. And the purpose of this committee was to advise and assist the Council in its military operations. But because of the ideological differences, the Cold War, the Military Staff Committee could never agree on what force the UN Security Council should have or how it was to be deployed. And so to this day, five men in dead and polished uniforms assemble in a basement room at UN headquarters at the beginning of each month, and their sole function is to move over one seat to signify the monthly change in chairmanship, a kind of Gilbert and Sullivan performance without music or humor. This is today's United Nations Military Staff Committee. Of course, the members of the Military Staff Committee were not personally responsible for this deadlock. They, like all representatives who came to the United Nations, represented their governments, their foreign offices, and their executive branches, and had to carry out the views of those governments. So as a consequence, the debate that ensued over this military force for the UN Security Council was marked by the Cold War between the United States and the Soviet Union. I think it came pretty much to a head in a Security Council meeting, which I believe was in June 1947, in which the United States and the Soviet Union expressed their views. The United States, backed up by the United Kingdom, France, and China, said that each of the big five should contribute to the international force that which each was best able to contribute. In other words, the principle of comparability. The Russians, on the other hand, said there should be equal contributions. In carrying on this debate, Herschel Johnson, who then represented the United States, pointed out that for the United States, the flaw in the Russian plan to accept the principle of man for man and gun for gun would keep the world forced down to the strength of the weakest nation. On the other hand, the United States contended that each nation should contribute what it was most able to contribute. And Soviet delegate Gromyko argued that this comparability, as it was called, opened the way for certain powerful nations to take advantage over others. He said the UN does not need a huge armed force if it is sincere about disarmament. And he said it was impossible to accept the principle of comparability. That deadlock has never been resolved, and so the Security Council has never had the force that was provided for in the Charter.
Since the police power provided for in the Charter was never implemented, a number of ad hoc arrangements have been devised from time to time to deal with emergencies. Could you give us some examples?
Well, since 1947, for example, UN observers who keep watch on explosive situations, report back to the Secretary General or Security Council or General Assembly, have been sent to many trouble spots in places like Indonesia, the Middle East, Kashmir, Greece, Lebanon, and Yemen. Now, they have usually been designated by the Secretary General with a mandate from either the Security Council or the General Assembly. Of course, the Korean War presented the UN with a particular problem when President Truman sent American land and sea forces to try to stem the invasion from North Korea, and at the same time asked members of the United Nations to join the United States in this particular operation. There was a small response for military fighting men from members of the UN, but most of the replies had to do with sending supplies to help out the repelling of aggressors. The Security Council was able to act positively that Sunday when the appeal came to the UN because Soviet delegate Malik had walked out the previous January over the fact that the United States would not permit the seating of Communist China in the UN. And as a consequence, there was no veto to block action to come to the aid of South Korea. Those who did respond served under a unified American command in Korea, frequently referred to erroneously as a UN command. But the largest UN military force, ONUC, O-N-U-C, so far has operated in the Congo, now there, from 1960 to 1964. And that was in response to a request from the Congo for aid to help stem a revolution in the Congo when the Belgians released that country to independence. Secretary General Hammarskjöld brought the matter before the Security Council and the UN responded to his request, and this became quite a policing operation, the biggest the United Nations has ever known. Of course, UN peacekeeping troops have been stationed on Cyprus. This was known as UNFICYP, UNFICYP, since the outbreak of Greek-Turkish fighting in 1964. I believe there's something like four wars in the Middle East produced UN peacekeeping operations, in addition to the Truce Supervision Organization, which established headquarters in Jerusalem in 1948. That was known as UNTSO, U-N-T-S-O. The first emergency force, UNEF-1, came about as a result of a conflict among the big powers, believe it or not. Great Britain and France had decided to go in and deal with Egypt's President Nasser because he had nationalized the Suez Canal. And this meant military action. The United States was on the outside and objected to this. And so, as a consequence, when the Security Council acted, Britain and France both cast vetoes, which blocked the action. The United States then, under President Eisenhower and Secretary of State Dulles, decided to bring the matter to the UN General Assembly instead of sending in American military forces to try to right the situation. As a consequence, UNEF, the first emergency force, was set up by the on the mandate of the Security Council. The first emergency force, UNEF, was set up by Secretary General Hammarskjöld, working in tandem with Assembly President Lester Pearson, when the General Assembly gave him a mandate to send UN peacekeeping forces into Egypt to try to prevent the taking over of the Suez Canal by outside forces. I was on the plane with Secretary General Hammarskjöld on that particular historic mission and was able to go as far as Naples when he said that unfortunately he could not take a reporter beyond that point since the UNEF forces were being taken in by Swiss military planes. This UNEF force was set up along a demarcation line as long as the UN troops were on the Egyptian side of the line. Israel had been a part of the British-French operation against the canal, but it would not permit any UN forces on its side of the line. The 1973 Middle East War produced UNEF II, and that was stationed in the Sinai until, I believe it was 1979. In addition, there's been a disengagement unit, as they called it, UNDOF, UNDOF, posted on Syria's Golan Heights in 1973. And in 1978, there was an interim force, UNIFIL, sent to southern Lebanon to supervise withdrawal of invading Israeli troops, which, of course, has not yet occurred. But the UN force is still in southern Lebanon.
What can you say about the role of the Secretary General in such UN peacekeeping operations?
The Secretary General has always been a prime factor in these peacekeeping operations. For example, when the United States asked for UN help in Korea, Secretary General Trygve Lie supported the American appeal. Unfortunately, it finally left to his departure from the UN because the Soviet Union never forgave him. Secretary General Hammarskjöld, of course, was most active in setting up peacekeeping forces, particularly UNEF 1 and 2 and the Congo force. And Secretary General Font was left to supervise the withdrawal of the force from Egypt because Egypt would no longer have the UN troops on its soil, and Israel refused to accept them. He also had to supervise the wind-up of the Congo operation.
Mr. Lie was succeeded in April 1953 by Dag Hammarskjöld of Sweden. What can you say about him?
Interestingly enough, Dag Hammarskjöld was incurring the disfavor of the Soviet Union, as Lee had, because of his operation in the Congo. The Soviet Union accused him of siding with the West in that respect and trying to keep communism out of the Congo. As a consequence, before his death, the Soviet Union was demanding his resignation and his replacement by a troika. When Dag Hammarskjöld was first appointed Secretary General, very little was known about him beyond his own circle of immediate friends. He was in the Foreign Office, Swedish Foreign Office, and it was assumed that after Lee's experience, he would not take too much initiative, but on the other hand, would be more of an administrative officer at the U.S. So much to the surprise of everybody, he became much more of a leader in initiating peacekeeping operations and peacekeeping devices to try to ease some of the tensions in the world than had the previous Secretary General. And like Trygve Lie, it wasn't long before he was in trouble with the Russians for what they considered siding with the West.